Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Will tigers go extinct within our lifetimes? An estimated 4,000 of these extraordinary cats remain alive in the wild, plagued not only by habitats shrinking to make room for human activity, but also by a booming black market for tiger parts, believed to convey strength, health, and virility to those who possess them. Tigers are native to a number of Asian countries and are so precious that they often feature in traditional mythology. But conservation efforts are land and manpower intensive, and often governments and wildlife advocacy organizations disagree on the best methods for protecting and managing tiger populations. National Geographic's Caroline Alexander is here to talk about it. She traveled through India, Thailand, and Myanmar for her article, A Cry for the Tiger, which appears in the December issue of the magazine. Caroline, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the thought that only 4,000 tigers remain in the wild is alarming enough, but it's doubly so when we consider that we had twice as many 30 years ago.
Yes, and that 4,000 figure, I would say most people would agree, is the upper limit of the estimate. The most discouraging thing about the situation when I sort of landed in this to do research is you're made aware of how long we have been saving tigers, and I sort of put that in quotation marks. I can say that in my lifetime, that the tiger, I have known of the tiger only as a threatened and rare animal, and that sort of has become one of its what I call defining attributes. I think if you speak to most people, they'll sort of shrug their shoulders and say, yes, you know, well, it's rare. And we've kind of lived with the idea of it being rare for so long, and we've never known it otherwise, that we've just come to accept that situation. And I think, you know, these alarms are sounded periodically for different species, and you never know quite how much attention to pay to them. But in this case, the numbers are very, very small. They're a maximum of 4,000, as you said. But more to the point, they've been declining ever since we've been trying to save this animal. So we have, up until this point at least, been failing, markedly failing to save this animal that everyone professes to care about.
How are wild tiger populations tracked?
Well, that's extraordinary task, and almost kind of mythic in a way. First of all, the tiger is a famously secretive animal. Mm-hmm. This is not even like other big cats, such as lions that hunt in prides or that inhabit, nice open grasslands where you can occasionally sort of catch a sight of them, or big animals, visible animals like elephants. These are famously secretive stalking animals. So to look for them, even in the best of circumstances, is extremely difficult. Tiger habitat is also very difficult. It's forested, jungly, very varied, but not easy for human beings to infiltrate. So part of the problem with tiger conservation has been just trying to figure out how many tigers there actually are in any one given protected area. And this has generated a whole new kind of science of survey taking. So, for example, one method that had been used and is, I think, much criticized now was just looking for pug marks, the tiger paw prints. And you see these, they're often along river tracks because the tigers need water, and you see them and you can say, okay, there's a tiger. And there's a fine art then to studying the paw prints and determining if it's one tiger, the same tiger, and so on and so forth. But more alarmingly, leopards also leave paw prints. And when a leopard paw print spreads out over a bit of time in a nice sandy base, it can look like a tiger print. Mm. And so things like this have been extremely difficult to refine, and now they're much more high-tech, sophisticated, and systematic methods of doing census taking, which have yielded, for example, the latest tiger survey in India, which are numbers I think people more or less stand by. But that was the result of work done in 2010-2011, which shows you how long it's taken for us humans, the caretakers, even to do something as basic as count the number of animals we're trying to protect.
Something like half the wild tigers left in the world live in India. How stable is that population?
Well, very few tiger populations are stable to the point where one could turn one's back on them and say, okay, they're there for a lifetime.
Yeah.
But within India, there's sort of several different categories. At the high end, the bright end, are some of the great enduring success stories. And these are places, particularly in central India, parks like Kanha, in the western Ghats region, which is right along the sea there on the west, where a legendary reserve under a legendary tiger biologist, Ulus Karanth, called Nagarhol, is protected. These are places where there are robust wild tiger populations, great habitat that is monitored, great prey, and if they're not stable, nowhere is stable. Then you have other situations where you get these more isolated reserves, small. The one that I went to and saw my only tigers in, for example, in the north of India, is only 100 square miles,
mm-hmm.
and that's surrounded by human habitation. Now, the population in there is secure at the moment. It's had its ups and downs, but it's well tended now. It's got its maximum tiger density, which is about 41 or so tigers at this moment. But how stable is it? A proficient poaching team could take that up in well under a year, and that has happened in other such island reserves in India. So the bottom line is, I think India has got more tiger advocates than any other country I've been in, by which I mean that journalists and philanthropists and local NGOs are wildly, wildly passionate about the tiger, and they publish articles when there's slip-ups in the government, and they really, really keep the issue in public view. They're very committed and very able. But India is a very big country,
mm-hmm.
and resources are spread thin. And some reserves have, exemplary management, and some are more demoralized just because of wages and so forth. And I think it's fair to say that I'm hard pressed to say that any place is anywhere in the world is truly, truly stable.
Caroline, you mentioned that you spotted your first tiger in Ranthambore National Park in India. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what it was like after weeks and weeks of being on this story to actually see one?
Well, it was even more, I'd have to even backtrack to an earlier trip unrelated to this story. A couple of years previously, I had been in India in the swampy Sundarbans area for the New Yorker on a story there, and I had also seen no tigers. So this was this was an accumulation of many years of interest in trying to see a tiger, and I had been traveling for the Geographic story for several weeks, and as you say, in some of the best tiger habitat around, and I had seen evidence of tigers, such as thrilling paw prints, but I had not yet seen a tiger. And so I had chosen this place, Ranthambore, in Rajasthan, because it's one of a sort of handful of reserves that have good reputation for tourists. I mean, this is unabashedly a tourist destination. There are, lodges and comfortable places to stay around the edge. You can travel in comfort. But this is how one sees today, really, truly, tigers in the wild. And so I had sort of put all my eggs in this basket and arrived at the head of the tourist line of cars that lines up at dawn to enter the park gates, And I was at the head of the queue because I had the most sort of bloodthirsty driver, I think, in the whole of India, who just, driving in these parks is a blood sport in itself. Mm-hmm. It's highly competitive amongst the different drivers. So he sort of barged the front of the queue, and then we, you know, blasted out as the gates opened, and then suddenly you're sort of creeping along on a red, dusty red road, and the light is very, very low because it's dawn is just breaking, and there's a kind of goldy mist that happens as the light comes through the trees, and the ground, the soil is red and reflects gold. And suddenly there was a tiger in the sort of tigery gold mist, and it was so... You know, you see something as iconographic as this animal, and it's very hard to sort out what you're seeing. And what I think, what I brought away was the sense that the animal is so remarkable that if, you know, for a moment what falls away are all the images you've seen in magazines and on TV shows, and you're sort of left for this flash second with something very primal and very instinctive, and you're staring at it and you really can't believe it because it's a huge cat, and it looks like a cat. It looks like a cat, domestic cat. I mean, it's unmistakably a cat, and so you have a huge, orange, gorgeous, improbable cat, striped, staring at you with this sort of cat-like indifference, which I loved, and it's thrilling, but in a sort of bewildering way. That and then you sort of scratch your head and you think, you sort of pull back, or I pulled back and I thought, you know, this is if I had never known about this animal, what on earth would I have thought to sort of come on something so improbable and obviously powerful? It's an animal that lives up to all the press and media coverage glamorizing it. It certainly in the flesh and blood earns its reputation. I think anybody listening who's had the privilege of seeing an animal would agree with me on this.
You know, it's interesting. I have only seen tigers in zoos, and that's thrilling enough. The way you describe it, it almost sounds like when you see a famous person whose pictures you've seen in the movies and in magazines and things like that, and you almost can't believe your eyes.
You can't, yes. That's a very good way of putting it. You identify it as a tiger because it looks like a tiger. It looks like a tiger because you've seen pictures of tigers. And there it, and even though you're looking for it, I'd been spending weeks straining to look for it, and suddenly there it is, and it's your brain doesn't quite catch up to your emotions, as it were. It's sort of a beat in between there. And then I think what most fascinated me, and I hope this won't be irritating to the more scientifically minded, because this is definitely a kind of not anthropomorphizing, but it's sort of, I'm not a scientist, and I sort of take the animals on a perhaps a more emotional, sentimental basis than many would approve of. But I couldn't get over how much like a cat, a domestic cat, it looked. And when I watched, had 9 tiger sightings, and I saw tigers sleeping by rivers, I saw drinking in the water, I saw stalking, and at the end, you know, I was almost smiling with amusement, with recognition, because I would watch the tiger stalk and its whiskers would go forwards, you know, as it saw its prey, and I would think of, you know, my own cat. And, it's a remarkable place where we in the 21st century are, where we have a kind of...
Let me jump in here. I'm sorry, we need to take a quick break. Caroline Alexander is with us from National Geographic. Her new article is called A Cry for the Tiger. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Caroline Alexander is with us from National Geographic magazine. Her article in the December issue is called A Cry for the Tiger. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send emails to think@kera.org. Caroline, you have just given us this spectacular description of this magnificent animal, and I'm left wondering how could anybody experience the same thing and then want to shoot a tiger?
It's astonishing. Some years ago on another wholly unrelated story, I was once allowed to look into U.S. Fish and Wildlife's kind of sin bin, which was a huge warehouse on the West Coast where there were confiscated illegal wildlife objects. Mm-hmm. And the memory of it stays with me as this kind of colossal monument to the banality of the human imagination. I mean, you saw animal parts there of, in this case, I remember polar bears, you know, that had been part had turned into a handbag. I mean, you can't think what goes through people's heads that they can make the association from these banal objects with these magnificent animals. The tiger trade, which is what is killing tigers, is fueled by several forces. The most famous or notorious, perhaps, is the so-called Chinese medicine trade. This is, in fact, an unfair classification because Chinese traditional medicine has repudiated the use of tiger parts in its traditional recipes, which is to say that the board of practitioners who control Chinese traditional medicine or regulate it in the same way that Western medicine is regulated have for some 17, 18 years, you know, repudiated this. So what is the tiger parts are being used for is not even in anybody's imagination, respectful imagination, legitimate. It's superstitious. It's unfounded, unbased, superstitious traditions. And every single part of the tiger, unfortunately, is seen as having some kind of medicinal value. And with the resurgence or surgence of a prosperous class in China and other parts of Asia, there's more income for these kind of prestige traditions or practices, and that is in great part where the money goes that fuels the poaching of these animals. The other perhaps very potent and dangerous source, but less well known, is that parts of the tiger skin have been used decoratively in traditional Tibetan garments, for example. And although the Dalai Lama has repudiated this practice, again, old ways die hard. So tigers face, like many animals, face many threats, such as loss of habitat, you know, poaching of their prey, land use issues, contact with human communities, but the single issue that is bleeding them out right now today is the deliberate killing of them by human beings for a black market trade.
Can anything be done? You mentioned the different groups and individuals who have said, please do not do this, but can anything be done from the demand side? It's almost like the drug problem. If you could at least stop people from paying money to have these things killed, maybe you could have fewer of them killed.
I think there are two, or let me report from what the professionals believe, that there's sort of two approaches that desperately are being taken and hopefully will stick. One is just basic law enforcement, boots on the ground in tiger reserves. Many of these areas are so-called protected, but they're not monitored in the kind of way that law enforcement has to monitor areas of high crime potential, mm-hmm. which is that you need guards there patrolling. These are not shootout situations. Most tigers are killed with poison or snares or traps, and you just need troops or rangers in there, trained professional wildlife officers at ranger, doing foot patrols, seeing what's going on, checking if prey are being killed, if they're poaching camps that they can disrupt, if there's snares that can be taken up, just being a nuisance, just getting in there in the way of potential poachers so that they are afraid to come in. So that's the kind of immediate solution or immediate strategy that has to be adopted. But the other, as you say, is more a kind of public relations campaign at the source. And there are grassroots organizations within China and within the Chinese communities and in other parts of the world that are desperately concerned about this. I perceive it as a generational issue as much as anything. I think, you know, that conservation is came later perhaps in parts of Asia than it has in the West. We were ahead of them in killing off many of our own animals, so we adapted quicker. But I think that what has to be done, I mean, I don't know if there are ways that alternate remedies could be just packaged and marketed and marketed and marketed so that they somehow took hold in people's minds as being the effective fever reducer as opposed to ground tiger bone.
Mm-hmm.
Some interesting surveys have been taken of Chinese communities within China regarding the use of these traditions. And I mean, they're very contradictory. Most people say, you know, wild tigers must be saved, something like 93% of respondents. But over half of them said that they used tiger products for medicine. And majority of them, 73% or so, said that they thought wild tiger's bones would be better than, say, tame tiger bones. So I suppose the good news you take out of that is at least an awareness that the animals are threatened, that they won't be around, and, you know, and maybe that the, you know, that's the wedge that you use to drive the issue home. But I think it's something that can't really be dictated to from the West. We've got to very much rely on the conservation-minded Chinese, work with them, with young generations. I would hope the new social networking technology could be a great advantage to sort of getting messages out and getting the cause out. But until it's stopped at the, until there is no demand, that this is always going to be a problem.
At the risk of sounding flip, I mean, it seems like an ideal, marketing opportunity for people who make Advil and Viagra to sort of get in there.
I absolutely agree. And I heard, you've reminded me to check this anecdotally. I heard that there had been some overture by Viagra, and which made all the sense in the world, since, as you're probably aware, one of the other things that certain tiger parts are meant to do is, stop male impotence or increase male potency. I don't know if they did that by tiger packaging of the product. Mm-hmm. If you put a striped orange package on it, would it make it helpful? The only problem with those kinds of strategies is that they keep reinforcing the tigerness in it. So, for example, there's strong movement within China to, there are these dreadful tiger farms, which are thought to hold up to sort of 5,000 tigers, which are being advocates within China are saying, look, you know, they're not wild tigers, we can kill them, we can use these parts. And apart from it sort of being an appalling concept, it also keeps alive the superstition that tiger parts are medicinal. And that idea in any shape or form is what one needs to address and just say, look, you know, your grandfathers believed it just as we in the West believed eye of Newton, toe of frog and all of that, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the better things, but just retire the whole idea of tigers. And so I don't know how one does that, except as you say, I mean, new products are marketed every day, and I would think it would be a great niche for some entrepreneur to just go in there and blitz, with some kind of effective PR media and get a new product up and running. But that's sort of, I don't know how realistic that dream is.
I was interested to read in the article that a healthy adult female can produce 6 to 8 cubs over the course of her lifetime. Are most of those cubs likely to survive?
That figure is actually, it's even higher. That's the adjusted figure. I think it says, the article says rear. A female tiger will produce up to 15, 16 tigers over cubs over her lifetime. Usually about half of those reach breeding age themselves, which is a high number. This is not... one of the heartbreaking things about the tiger is that it's so spectacularly successful and adaptive as a species. It breeds, the tiger breeds well, populations can bounce back. This is not a persnickety animal like the panda, which can only live in one place or eat a very particular type of food and very slow to breed. This is an animal with spectacular habitat range from... evidence of tigers have been found in the Himalayan foothills above 1,300 feet and then all the way down to the swampy Sundarbans area where I was some years ago, where they're aquatic. There are very few animals that have such adaptability to climates and ecosystems and range and so on the one hand, and on the other hand, they breed very well. And so this is a species that, is, you know, as I see it, has done everything it possibly can to adapt to man. It's expanded its range. It's an animal that's hardwired to survive. It's hardwired to proliferate. And all it needs is a kind of period to draw breath, just sanctuaries that are protected well enough to defend the core populations and allow those core populations to rebound and then enough habitat around to disperse. There's sufficient habitat, although its habitat has been catastrophically in some ways reduced, there is still, in theory, enough habitat in the world right now to support some 20,000 tigers. And so we just need to let the animals, you know, recover on, be left alone to recover.
Tell us what wildlife corridors are and why they're thought to be such a key element in tiger conservation.
Wildlife corridors are those tracts of designated habitat of one kind or another that allow animals, not just tigers, but also their prey, to migrate safely from one protected reserve to another. So, for example, the situation that I referred to earlier in India, where you get these parks, for example, that are surrounded by people, these are very difficult places because, on the one hand, they're holding pools for small, robust populations of tigers, but on the other hand, they don't have much genetic variability or any potential for genetic variability because the tigers can't go anywhere. Or if they do go somewhere, they're going to go out and mingle with human populations, and that's where trouble happens for both man and animal. So the wildlife corridors are attempts, are sort of structures where tiger biologists have sort of watched tiger range movements, watch where the prey moves and the tigers followed, and tried to say, okay, if we put aside this area, we know that there's human habitation here, but if the animals are allowed to sort of pass unmolested from this place to this, then we get the kind of genetic the kind of dispersal that's necessary for genetic diversity on the one hand, and we allow the tigers to follow their instincts and range. And wildlife corridors are very different from some of the core sanctuary areas, which must be inviolate and as close to pristine as one can accommodate. A wildlife corridor can be a cassava field. Mm-hmm. I mean, tigers have sort of wandered through villages for many, many, many generations, and generally speaking, without causing damage unless they themselves are in some way old or injured, and that's when they attack livestock and sometimes very tragically people. But it's thought, you know, that if they're just allowed to wander, they tend to be nocturnal. If they can go from A to B, and people know, just don't shoot them when you see them, just let them go on their way. But all of this takes, as you can imagine, this is a extraordinarily difficult kind of arrangement to set up, in that you have to, first of all, identify the best places. You have to then try and work with people who are very understandably nervous about, you know, what this might mean with this kind of proximity to their livelihoods as well as lives. And some places, I know that there have been government officials in India who've simply said, you know, this isn't tenable. We can't do it in India. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it can't be done in some of the other countries, but it's certainly a strategy that has to be worked on in those places wherever it is possible.
It really is an understandably complex issue. I mean, in theory, I would support it. On the other hand, I'm glad that my 9-year-old isn't playing near a tiger corridor, and there are human beings who live near these regions.
Yes, live and have livestock. Most of these are, by definition, rural areas. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about farming places where people have cattle or goats, and those have tended to be the traditional victims of tiger attacks. And so the first thing that has to be established is just livelihood compensation that is reliable, immediate, so that people know that if I lose my cow, my family won't starve. And these kinds of, strategies are what people, conservationists, have been sort of trying to finesse for a very long time. I mean, it's very difficult to get the right balance between man and animal. And some places, I think, have to be kind of written off, that it's just not going to be feasible. But there, some of the wilder areas outside of, particularly out of India, in the Terai Arc of northern India and Nepal, for instance, is a good example of where the system seems to be working.
Journalist Caroline Alexander is with us from National Geographic magazine, which features her article, A Cry for the Tiger, in the current issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send a question via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Caroline Alexander from National Geographic magazine. You can read her article, A Cry for the Tiger, in the December issue. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Caroline, you quote in the article an advocate for tiger conservation who says that often wildlife NGOs and governments in tiger countries find themselves working at cross purposes. What are the major sources of conflict?
Well, it's a messy tiger conservation, like many species conservation, is just messy. In the ideal world, one would fund and protect all areas of a complex tiger landscape. So you would protect the core populations in inviolate sanctuaries. You would protect buffer zones outside those sanctuaries. You'd protect wildlife corridors connecting to wider other protected regions. And you'd work with all the communities at the margins, which has sometimes meant relocating populations voluntarily and for compensation. It sometimes meant working with them to develop ecotourism projects where they benefit very directly from having tigers as a draw within their area. And you can imagine already the proliferation of different types of projects. Mm-hmm. In different types, there are 14 tiger range countries, and they've all got different cultures, all fragmented amongst different communities, all have local officials who have to face their local communities, and got very uneven resources. And so it's trying to bring everybody to kind of focus on a plan of action across the boards, which is very, very difficult. And one, I think it's fair to say that for the tigers have been actively being saved, if you will, since the 1970s. That's when people became alarmed about tiger numbers, which were at that time about twice what they are today. And for the first decades, I think it's fair to say that this was a stumbling effort because people were starting cold. They didn't have some of the sophisticated technology of tracking, which I mentioned earlier, or census taking, or even a coherent, tried and true strategy. So what people tended to do was just sort of wrap their arms around an area and say, okay, you know, nobody goes in here, nobody goes out. And that led to some of these kind of isolated island reserves where we have the tigers kind of bottled up. So how do you get, what works is the problem. And I would say that in the last decade or even less than a decade, the science has become more pointed, the stakes have become higher, and people have begun to winnow away the things they know don't work. And at this point, I think the most parties agree that the single thing that everybody has to do right now is just protect the tigers that are still there. And that seems very obvious. I think the listeners will scratch their heads and say, isn't that what they were doing all along? And the answer is no, because in some cases you go in and you try and say, okay, we'll start and get up local community participation, we'll get them on board, we'll show them how wonderful the tiger is, we'll remind them they're in their culture, and you kind of work backwards or inwards towards the great goal of saving the population there. And in an ideal world, there would be time to do it exactly that way. But we're not in an ideal world anymore. And, tigers are bleeding away, and areas, parks can be wiped out, as India saw within the space of a couple of years, and lost entire populations of their tigers to poachers. And so what has to be done now, and most would agree, is that all other peripheral plans have to be dropped, and they just have to protect the core populations. And that means the most perhaps difficult part of tiger conservation, which is patrolling, equipping enough people to cover wide, difficult areas of terrain, to just put up camera traps to monitor what's going on, to get in there on the ground, to do systematic, scientifically sound surveys that cover whole areas and just aggressively go in and in and in and in, like any other kind of law enforcement job. And that's less tasteful to many people than, say, doing community outreach programs, where you kind of feel you're doing directly good to mankind and directly good for the animals. But unfortunately, in 2011, those higher-minded programs are not saving tigers.
You know, I learned so much reading this piece, Caroline, but I think my favorite takeaway was this new respect I have for tiger rangers. They are not doing easy work. They are often not well compensated, and they're living and working under very difficult conditions.
Oh, extraordinary, extraordinary insight to me. I mean, the place I went to in Myanmar, it's the Hukong Valley in northern, what was northern Burma. And many people who know their World War II history would know this is the area where American planes, quote, flew the hump, which was flying air supplies at very difficult altitudes from India into China, one of the heroic endeavors of World War II. And many, many planes crashed, American cargo planes from World War II crashed in the Hukong Valley where this tiger reserve now is. Those planes are lost. This jungle is deep enough, big enough, fearsome enough to have swallowed hundreds of downed cargo planes. And yet these rangers have to go in and negotiate this kind of territory. You know, it's extraordinarily difficult. It's not just like going hiking in, you know, in a nice kind of guided national park or something. It's malarial. Rangers die of malaria. There are all kinds of hazards from snakes And, you know, it's uncomfortable. They're often there. You know, one of them describes sort of not seeing the sky on his six-week patrols because he was under canopy or low clouds. It's incredibly difficult work, and these are the heroes of this story.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have George on the line in Plano. Hi, George.
Hi. Yes, ma'am. I was wondering, you know, for the future, if there might be much of a chance of our gathering up as many tigers as possible and possibly bringing them over here to America or maybe, you know, to the UK or some of the other, you know, really well-developed countries where it might be a little easier to try to protect them and also, you know, where the culture might be more receptive to their existence.
Well, there's strange to say that idea has been is being conducted or implemented in China, and there's a group that have taken what remnant there is of the South China tigers and have taken them to South Africa where they're rearing them, and then they're going to try and reintroduce them into the wild. That's the desperate, I mean, there are now, right now, already more tigers in America than there are in the wild, right now. And there are more tigers in farms in China than there are in the wild. There are about 10,000 tigers in China and America in zoos or private collections. It's very unregulated. And there are about maximum 4,000 tigers in the wild. So arguably, that strategy has already taken place. I think that part of the what one loses with this kind of zoo strategy is the very concept of wildness. And I think that part of the mystique of the tiger and part of it, of all the adjectives we invest it with, majestic, secretive, you know, are predicated on that wildness. And when that is taken away and you have only zoo animals, which are necessary and desirable to be seen, and if well run, you know, certainly an asset, I think, to the general cause, but you lose forever what we're all trying to protect. And then there are others, people are sort of more opportunistically say, look, the tiger is the apex predator of a complex ecosystem, and when you save the tiger, you're saving the entire ecosystem. You're saving all the forests. They're the guardians of the forest, and so they stand as symbols of something more than just themselves.
I wonder if you can speak for just a minute, Caroline, about the challenges. I mean, it was hard enough for you to conduct your research and go all around and only really spot tigers in one location. The photographer who worked on the piece has some extraordinary images here, but what did it take to collect those?
Well, Steve Winters is an extraordinary photographer. He is the photographer who took these, and indeed he is responsible for this story. National Geographic sort of receives story suggestions by a number of sources, more often from writers or generated internally, but this came from Steve himself, who is one of the premier photographers of big cats in the world. His work on snow leopards appeared a couple of years ago in National Geographic, and he's done remarkable work on jaguars. The best pictures I've ever seen of any of the big cats have been taken by Steve Winters, and he's completely and utterly dedicated about big cats and particularly tigers. And so, I mean, he does a lot of his work through remote camera trapping of a very sophisticated nature as opposed to the kind of crude camera trapping that's used just to count tigers. But this is a kind of fine art. It means knowing a lot about consulting with local people, where are the tiger trails, where would I best set it up. And so he has to learn a lot about the ways of the tiger in order to be a good tiger photographer. And the sort of joke I think that we all had was that you needed one of those long hooks to sort of go out and just drag him back in from the field, because he is so dedicated to this that it was hard to pry him loose.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Bruce in Tyler. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon or good morning. Mm-hmm. My question is: Are there different types of subspecies of the tigers? And the other question would be: Has there been any a reintroduction of a tiger born in captivity back in the wild?
There are many, number of subspecies. Three subspecies have gone extinct: the Caspian tiger, the Bali tiger, and the Javanese tiger, and it's thought the South China tiger. So species that remain are the Amur tiger in the Russian Far East, the Bengal tiger, an Indochina China tiger, and Malayan tiger. And I do not know of instances where individual tigers have been reintroduced, which is not to say it hasn't happened, but I'm not aware of it as I am aware of it being done with lions, for example. But an interesting project that's now being floated is the attempt to reintroduce an entire species, the extinct Caspian tiger. It's found from recent studies to be virtually genetically identical to the Amur tiger of the Russian Far East. And the Caspian tiger range, ironically, survives intact. Thousands and thousands of square kilometers of space, a lot of it in Kazakhstan. So the thought is now, could one use the Amur tiger and other tigers in captivity, which bear the genetic markers, to try and reintroduce an entire new species?
What do you recommend to wildlife philanthropists who would like to help and want to make sure that their money is not going to a counterproductive effort?
Well, I guess I would have to, I've tried to be sort of impartial, but I would steer people probably, when the chips are down, to Panthera, which is, you can look on, they have a website. Panthera, Steve Winters, the photographer, is associated with Panthera, and he certainly could have put his services to many other organizations, but chose them. They're relatively new, but therefore have the advantage of being able to avoid old mistakes. Perhaps unfairly, they haven't had a chance to be judged yet either, but they seem to be, in my view, were doing the kind of boots-on-the-ground work that everybody seems to agree needed to be done. They were very, very much in the field, and their array of wild top tiger biologists that work for them is truly dazzling. So I would probably say that that's a good, safe bet. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife would Save the Tiger Fund, which has also done great work, recently transferred their funds, as it were, to Panthera, and I take that as a good endorsement.
Caroline Alexander's article in the New National Geographic is called A Cry for the Tiger. Caroline, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.